This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, and thank you for listening to this edition of Analysis, the programme that looks at some of the ideas behind the news. In this edition, Michael Muthukrishna of the London School of Economics is looking at the relationship between scientific research and cancel culture.
Turn on the TV or scroll through social media and you'll hear two words that take you straight to the heart of a raging culture war.
Is this cancel culture in full voice? Students at University College London disrupting a debate featuring the outspoken atheist Richard Dawkins.
Cancel culture is real, it's insane, and it's growing exponentially, and it's coming to a neighborhood near you.
A lot of the dangers of cancel culture and, you know, we're just going to be condemning people all the time, you know, you'll see folks going overboard.
Even here on Radio 4, it's the stuff of satire and comedy.
Welcome to Athena's Cancel Culture with me, Athena Kablenyu. A series about something we love doing to other people but would hate having done to us. What is cancel culture?
Good question, Athena. What is cancel culture? Cancel culture is when groups of people try to ostracize, shun, or otherwise shut down a person whose arguments or actions are deemed questionable, controversial, or harmful. It's the opposite of engaging with their arguments or presenting critiques of their actions.
So there are some binaries.
Security! Did they shut off the volume? Can you hear? This is a university. If we cannot have this conversation here, we can't have it anywhere.
My name is Michael Muthukrishna, and I'm Associate Professor of Economic Psychology at the London School of Economics. I work on questions in evolutionary biology, behavioral science, and human culture. But that's not why I'm interested in cancel culture. I'm what you might call a mid-career scientist. And over my career, I've noticed a shift in tone within the scientific community. Our debates have always been fierce, but ganging up on someone whose arguments we disagree with has rarely been so openly hostile and politicized. Part of the shift might be blamed on social media. Take Twitter, for example. They say every day Twitter has a new main character, and the goal is to never be that character. Many public figures, from sports stars to celebrities, have faced what could be described as a canceling. It's extremely stressful and leaves a dent on their reputation. But as a scientist, what I'm worried about is something bigger than one individual. I'm worried about what cancellation, or even the fear of cancellation, is doing to science. But maybe I shouldn't be. Like any good scientist, I'm ready to change my mind.
I think cancel culture isn't real. It's just two words put together trying to take over a conversation about discrimination and bigotry.
For this edition of Analysis, I've been speaking to many different voices in the scientific community to try and get a clearer picture of this highly contentious phenomenon.
I think a lot of people cry cancel culture when in fact what they're seeing is accountability for their actions.
I've been on a search for those who've been threatened with a cancellation.
They made the usual attempt to cancel me. They bombarded my department and every organization that I'm a member of, everyone that I'm connected with, to basically disown me, expel me, fire me, etc., etc., etc.
And finding out how this phenomenon could be affecting the behavior of scientists working today.
Geneticists have been loath to talk about the possibility of afrogenetic differences amongst groups because it's such a topic that provokes anxiety. Because geneticists have been loath to talk about it, they've left a vacuum that's gotten filled with pseudoscience.
We begin with a letter.
More than 150 writers, activists, and academics have signed an open letter saying freedom of speech is under threat in North America.
It was in July 2020, a number of well-known individuals, including J.K. Rowling, Noam Chomsky, and Garry Kasparov, penned an open letter published in Harper's Bazaar magazine, decrying what they call the illiberalism spreading across society. Another of the signatories to that letter was one of America's most prominent scientists, Harvard University's Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker thinks cancel culture and its pernicious effects are a major issue. Without the free exchange of ideas within science, he believes we can't address some of the biggest challenges facing us today.
There could be no more important question facing the world now than the origin of pandemics. We really, really want to know how COVID-19 originated and how other pandemics in the future, possibly worse ones, might originate. Now, we've got a regime now in American universities where if you raise the question, could the SARS-CoV-2 virus have escaped from the Wuhan virology lab? I think probably not, but we really do want to know. Well, you'll be called a racist, and you can be fired from your position for raising this hypothesis. This is a terrible state of affairs, and it's just one example of the kind of forced ignorance or forced error that we will be coerced into under a regime in which certain ideas are not sayable.
But just how damaging is this phenomenon? Many academics work toward what in America is known as academic tenure. It essentially means a job for life, unfireability. The idea is that it allows academics to research freely and speak freely without fear of being fired. But it's hard to get tenure, and not all academics are in this position. To get there can take years working on temporary contracts. Pinker is a tenured professor of cognitive science at Harvard. Could he be canceled?
I'm not canceled, but it's not about me. It's about the people with less power than a tenured Harvard professor who will be intimidated from expressing views precisely because their careers could be terminated. Their reputations could be trashed. The privileged few who have tenured positions don't have to worry, although even those of us who do have those privileges have been restricting the range of opinions that we say just because we don't need the trouble. This can distort our understanding of many important issues. It's a real phenomenon. There are numerous cases of people who've expressed opinions that go against a pretty narrow left-wing identity politics orthodoxy, who have been punished, fired, censored. One can see the results both in the culture of universities, where an increasing number of students feel that they can't express opinions, and where certain debates just aren't happening. There's a whispered discussion in some private internet forums, but even there's a snitch culture where someone can be exposed and then subject to punishment if one of their private opinions is divulged.
Restriction of free expression? Shutting down of debates? Snitch culture? Pinker paints a pretty depressing picture. Do academics, particularly early career academics, really fear that if they were to post the wrong opinion online or publish a paper that produces problematic results, that they might face severe professional and personal consequences? And is that fear founded? Well, for this program, my producer and I contacted a number of scientists working in academia, both here in the UK and the US, who have been the recipients of, let's say, unwanted press attention. Many didn't respond to our requests. Those that did declined to be interviewed. One response was typical. I've been turning down all recorded interviews relating to my current problems with my university because I'm still clinging to the hope that we might find constructive solutions and make some progress towards freedom of expression and open inquiry. But I did find one person who had faced what he calls a canceling attempt, and he was willing to speak. But before we hear his story, we need to head back to the US and into the world of computer science, where in recent years, a problem has been identified.
Hello, I'm Joy, a poet of code on a mission to stop an unseen force that's rising, a force that I call the coded gaze, my term for algorithmic bias.
You're probably thinking, wow, that sounds like a pretty sexist, racist person, right? These are some real decisions that AI has made very recently based on the biases it has learned from us.
AI is already as biased as humans. Now, computer scientists and AI experts at leading companies are aware of this and are working to find a solution, but there doesn't seem to be an easy fix.
People make biased decisions in ways that they can't help. There's even a bias in not seeing your own bias, what's called the bias blind spot. But can a computer, using artificial intelligence algorithms applied to big data sets, also be biased? One woman who is leading the campaign against perceived bias in AI is data scientist Brandeis Marshall, who describes herself as a rebel tech educator, scholar, and openly Black education activist.
Intrinsically in the data, there is what a lot of people like to call bias. I think bias is not necessarily the right word. I just like calling it inequities and discrimination, prejudice, bigotry that's inside of the data. And that is because individuals who are collecting the data and, of course, managing that data have biases and they superimpose inside of the data.
To help solve what Marshall sees as a lack of racial diversity in those who collect and manage the data, she started a training and consultancy firm called Data EdX, which advises businesses and individuals about this issue.
One of the reasons why I started the company was because every time there was a conversation about data, anytime there was tools or skill sets, it was always focused on playing with how data is modeled. And that data modeling tended to not represent me at all. Everything is centered on whiteness. The diversity inside of data science is one where it is low numbers, low instructional materials that highlight the Black positivity or positivity of any culture outside of white colonist culture. There's no place for all of the cultures that make up our society to exist inside of the digital realm, because it keeps getting moved out and pushed out by centering whiteness.
In early December, artificial intelligence ethics researcher Dr. Timneet Gebru received...
When it comes to the complex interplay between science and social justice activism, it doesn't get much more complicated than the current debate around biases in AI. In December 2020, the issue hit the headlines when a leading AI ethics researcher, Timneet Gebru, claimed she was sacked by Google.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I got fired. You don't resign in the middle of vacation and all of a sudden get cut off from the corporate email chain.
That was Timneet Gebru talking to Vice News in December 2020. So why was Gebru out of a job? She co-authored a paper on the risks of one type of AI, what are called large language models. AI needs data. The data in large language models are forums and other pages on the internet. But the internet doesn't always reflect the best of humanity, and Gebru argued, among other things, that this approach leads to harmful biases, encoding the sexism and racism and other biases you find online. When Google asked her to retract the paper or remove her name, she refused. And she found herself out of a job. Google denies Timneet Gebru's account of the events that led to her leaving the company. My producers sent several interview requests to Timneet, but unfortunately, she didn't respond. The paper that caused the controversy was co-authored with, amongst others, Emily Bender, a professor of linguistics at the University of Washington. When we spoke, I asked her what specific issues the paper highlighted.
Well, there are many. In the first instance, there is representational harms. So this is the idea that when you pick up stereotypes from text and then replay them, coming from the seemingly objective position of the computer, that can lead people to see those stereotypes as reinforced and as real. And that does direct psychological harm to somebody who's the subject of those stereotypes. And one of the things that we found in our paper is that people will say, oh, well, we're just reflecting the world as it is. But in fact, when you look at how the language data for the language models are collected, they don't reflect the world as it is. They reflect several different selection pressures that make it so that the text that's available for collecting is much more likely to reflect the worldview of people who have not been on the receiving end of discrimination and prejudice. Therefore, at the very best, don't know how to talk about it carefully, and at the worst, tend to reproduce it themselves.
I mean, what was it about the paper that caused such a ruckus at Google leading to Timneet's departure?
So I don't really know, because I don't work at Google, and so I wasn't privy to any of the internal discussions. But my impression is that it wasn't the paper alone, but that Dr. Gebru had been doing a lot of work to reshape Google as a workplace that was truly inclusive. And that kind of pushing causes friction, which looks like it's the fault of the person doing the pushing rather than the system they're pushing against.
Gebru received support from many academics, including some based here in the UK, with over 4,000 signing an open letter demanding transparency at Google. But when it comes to issues of bias in AI, not everyone agrees.
Google has made a huge effort to try to be more diverse. You know, a lot of the people at Google are very much social justice warriors as well, which is why this wound up blowing up in their face. But the problem is actually not just Google, of course, in the AI research community as a whole.
This is Pedro Domingos, a professor of computer science and engineering also at the University of Washington. Domingos believes that some of his fellow academics are putting their social justice activism ahead of their science.
To summarize, what they do is they just go about finding biases in one AI system after another. Every single one of those cases that I've seen, it's far from proven that there's a bias there. Typically, what they do is they observe a difference in outcomes between people of different races or between men and women or whatever, and they declare that to be a bias and to be discrimination and to be something that needs fixed. And that, you know, is actually somewhere between naive and wrong, I would say. Algorithms are much less biased than people are, and that's one of the best things about them, is that the decisions made properly can be better than the ones that are made by humans.
Domingos is also concerned about the broader impact of modern social justice movements on the field of computer science. Things came to a head in December last year over one of the leading conferences in artificial intelligence in the United States, the Conference on Neural Information Processing, or NeurIPS for short.
It's a very important conference if you want to publish machine learning research or certain types of AI research more generally. And as the social justice crowd turned its attention to AI, one of the things they have done step by step is to take over this conference. This year, for the first time, NeurIPS declared that every paper submitted to the conference must have a section on broader impacts of the research, meaning, you know, what will be the impact of this on society, on, you know, oppressed groups, or, you know, things like that. And then it is subject to review by an ethics board, which may lead to the paper being rejected, even if its scientific quality is unimpeachable. And this I find extremely alarming, because what it means is that the papers are effectively now subject to a form of censorship. And in fact, the self-censorship has already begun. People will not do certain kinds of research because they're afraid that it will fall afoul of the ethics board. And indeed, this year already, there were a few papers rejected for purely ethical reasons. And, you know, the word ethics sounds very innocuous, but when you look at the concrete things that are being done under that cover, they're just political choices that you may agree or disagree with. For example, enforcing equal outcomes for different groups is, again, one of the things that is explicitly named as being covered.
Upset by this latest development, Domingos took to Twitter to complain. One line in the call for submissions particularly concerned him. Regardless of scientific quality or contribution, a submission may be rejected for ethical considerations, including methods, applications, or data that create or reinforce unfair bias or that have a primary purpose of harm or injury. And he became Twitter's main character that day. But what happened next isn't the typical cancel culture story.
How this turned out was that they made the usual attempt to cancel me. They bombarded my department and every organization that I'm a member of, and, you know, everyone that I'm connected with, to basically disown me, expel me, fire me, etc., etc., etc. But they just failed comprehensively. What happened is interesting, is that the ringleader was the one who wound up getting canceled.
So who was that?
Anima Anand Kumar, right? Who's a machine learning researcher and a professor at Caltech, and very much a member of this crowd. And she issued a public apology for what she had done and has been silent ever since. I think everyone who is a victim of a cancel attack should be aware of how it works and how you can fight it and defeat it, because you are entitled to self-defense. A lot of people think that this won't happen to me because, you know, I'm a liberal and I kind of agree with these people are doing mostly, and they're not going to come after me. This is a complete illusion. In fact, their biggest attacks are not for conservatives, they're for moderate liberals. So you should be prepared.
So Domingos accuses the activists of trying to ruin his reputation through a divisive social media campaign. But in the end, he wasn't canceled. He received support from his colleagues. He kept his job. And instead, the individual he accused of leading the attempted cancellation, Anima Anand Kumar, ended up self-canceling. We asked Anand Kumar if she would like to take part in this program, but she declined. And here's the thing. The divisions are so deep that scientists can't even agree on whether cancel culture is real. Our producer invited one editor of a top scientific journal to appear on this program, who said, "I think the concept of cancel culture is absurd and would rather not give it any oxygen through affiliation." Here's Emily Bender again.
I think a lot of people cry cancel culture when in fact what they're seeing is accountability for their actions. A lot of the criticism does come from people whose privilege is being threatened. One of the things about privilege is that it operates on many dimensions, and the more dimensions you have privilege on, the harder it is to see and understand how to work with it appropriately. And so that's why the trope is, you know, white male, and then you can add further and further characteristics there, because that's, you're basically naming the privilege dimensions of a bunch of these systems of oppression.
Bender is right about the trope, but there's of course a base rate issue. It's changing, but there are a lot of senior white male scientists who are secure enough to complain. And certainly in my own career, I've seen a shift firsthand in hesitation and eventual self-censoring research and communication for fear of being canceled. It affects what young, non-white, non-male scientists write in their scientific papers and what they express on social media. It's a fear of being fired or not being hired, or reputational damage that prevents important invitations, or simply having to deal with a cancellation attempt instead of writing papers and grants, teaching and mentoring students, and getting on with the science. To get a fresh perspective on this thorny issue, I contacted someone who is no stranger to the online culture wars, writer and campaigner Caroline Criado Perez. In her mind, is cancel culture a thing?
I think it's really complicated. I think that there is no question that there is a chilling effect from bad faith actors online. I think it would be dishonest to try to claim that there wasn't. The difficulty is in separating out holding power to account and mob whipped up on its own righteous indignation, right? Like one person's righteous mob is another person's holding to account. So I don't have a very good answer for how you address it, but I think that that is the problem, is that both are going on and we don't yet have a very good way of separating them out.
Last year, Criado Perez published a now best-selling book, Invisible Women, which highlights gender bias in everything from medical research to car design. Arguably, this is the best of social justice in action. To get your research published in academia, it goes through peer review. Then there's what you might call a post-publication peer review. Other researchers read about it, debate it, write their own papers about it. Sometimes if they find a mistake not caught by peer review, the paper is retracted. But these days, there's also what you might call a post-publication social review, where non-experts scrutinize the paper on social media in ways that are not always about the science. Of course, there's a positive side to this. Anything that widens the conversation and encourages more people to participate in scientific research is a good thing. But as Criado Perez points out, it can also cause problems, especially in an age of cancel culture.
There was one paper in that it got sort of cancelled, for want of a better word, and it was these two academics in, I think, Korea, who wanted to look into whether there was a sex difference in, I think it was in intubation. The finding was that no, there's no sex differences, male and female anaesthetists perform it equally well. And the reason that they did this study was because there had previously been studies suggesting that there was a sex difference. But Twitter was incredibly outraged by this research having been done at all in the first place. And I think that's misguided for a couple of reasons. And I guess from my perspective, as someone who looks into how do things like the tools that we use prevent women from doing their job properly. You know, for example, personal protective equipment is something that I've looked into a lot, which generally is designed around the male body. Only 5% of women in the emergency services said that their PPE did not prevent them from doing their job properly. And in fact, I do know from having spoken to female medics that actually it is harder to perform an intubation as a woman because it has been designed around someone with more average male hand size. You know, I think the problem is that Twitter saw that as if they'd found a sex difference or even looking for a sex difference is to suggest that women are inferior. But actually, you could be looking for a sex difference to see, well, you know, the tools are not adequate.
Apparently, investigating sex differences in a particular profession can be controversial. So what's it like in even more contentious scientific fields?
In my field, people are very worried about being criticized for saying the wrong thing. And so there's a lot of fear. It makes it harder to think clearly and harder to discuss clearly and harder to make intellectual progress without having significant benefit.
This is David Reich. He's a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School. He's a preeminent geneticist and a pioneer in ancient DNA. he's figured out ways to quickly extract and sequence DNA from ancient skeletons, offering new insights into our evolutionary history and how humans have migrated across the globe. But his field has also become contentious for multiple reasons. He's studying human remains. He's revealing new findings about population differences and how populations have migrated around the world that doesn't always fit with the origin stories that people have about themselves.
Geneticists have been loath to talk about the possibility of afrogenetic differences amongst groups because it's such a topic that provokes anxiety. And because geneticists have been loath to talk about it, they've left a vacuum that's gotten filled with pseudoscience where people say, oh, those geneticists are pulling the wool over our eyes. We see around us all these different people. They look different. They have different propensities, as I can see with my own eyes. This must be due to genetics. And these correspond to traditional stereotypes. And there's many, many flaws with those arguments. So I think geneticists and scholars have a responsibility to have a discussion that's more than asserting there are no differences, and instead providing a sophisticated language to talk about the nature of the differences. I think some people felt that that was not a message that should be communicated.
I think most of us want to live in a fairer world, one in which we're not held back by our sex, the color of our skin, or the happenstance of our birth. But I think part of what drives these culture wars is that we have different ideas about how fair our current world is, and what changes are needed to get to a better world. I worry that there's a bias creeping into science where a fear of being canceled is preventing us from asking important questions or clearly reporting controversial answers. It's hard to solve a problem if you don't understand it, and it's hard to predict harm in advance. So if we want to figure out how to get to a better world, it might help to know more about ourselves, where we came from, and what might drive our similarities and differences. And a good place to start is by listening to scientists like David Reich.
No group today is in any sense pure, or really could be. We're a kind of a braid of ancient populations mixing again and again in the past. It's absolutely clear from studying ancient DNA that this is what's happening and that this is the nature of who we are, that we're recovering connections between people that we didn't know existed. And I think that this is a disruptive set of findings because it often disrupts stories that we had before, including people's stories about themselves. But I think it's something, in my view, that brings us together or has the potential to bring us together or to combat prejudice and xenophobia because it really shows how interconnected we are.
For what it's worth, I happen to agree with David Reich. But should anyone believe him if they thought saying the opposite would get him canceled? And there's the rub. Whether you think Reich is right or wrong should never be a reason to stop him or scientists like him from reporting their best attempts at explaining reality. Reality is complicated. Science is never settled, and it's hard to know in advance what will and won't cause harm. If we can't trust that the scientists are speaking freely, then how can we trust the science? And here's me, hoping that asking these questions doesn't get me canceled.
That was Analysis, presented by Michael Muthukrishna. It was produced by Craig Templeton-Smith. And if you enjoyed that edition, you'll find plenty more, all available on BBC Sounds.